Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Automation Update 22, or probably even 23. Pretty amazing that I'm still working away at the art of generating podcasts, or moreover, it's automation for podcasts that fit in with my rehabilitation. You can hear some Aussie birds above the place. So just to put you in the picture, I'm a Australian. This podcast is from Australia in the Southern Hemisphere. I'm just plugging away at physical and cognitive rehab after a pretty massive set of heart operations, or pretty great heart operations. And so I've got to look at a series of things. So recently I've swapped over to, in walking to carrying 2-3 kilo weights, you know, one on each hand as you're walking, as you do, just to limit the time and increase the amount of work that I'm doing. So I still have to knock off kilos and stuff like that. Somehow I still can't seem to do it. So that means, obviously, I'm carrying 3 kilo weights. I can't carry the little dictaphone, like a little mobile phone in front. And so what that probably means, I'll have to investigate microphones and see how that actually works. You know, those little ear microphones and little microphones in the cord. I have to see how that that works. It may not be a very good option. I'm not quite sure on how that all goes. You can see it's absolutely bird city around here. So I've got to look at that aspect of it. And for the actual base software, I'm just sort of slowly. It's all very stable, so it just takes your takes the podcast, records what it is, publishes it, ties it in a bow, checks that it's on the internet, so that's all stable. So all the faults I've sort of cleaned up, and it now detects also that if it's a multiple series podcast, it sort of concatenates that all together, puts it away, and then at the end when I do a series, like on a new scientist or something like that, I can put it in, it puts it fairly painlessly into an app. The app now is containing sort of 500 podcast items and efforts, so I might just open up a second one, because it's just, it sort of takes a little bit irritating long to open up as it's organising the 500 podcasts. So if it puts a new one, it sort of does a whole lot of multidimensional space adaptations in there, and it publishes it off to the internet. Not that anyone's particularly watching at this stage, but they will, I think. I think as time goes past, it's a definite thing to look at. So that's there. And then there's the grinding work. Development. I haven't really experienced development quite like this before, and so this is where I have decided a structure on how to create a multiple choice podcast thing. I'm slowly working towards it. I notice a few eager beavers out there have sort of broken in. So the general podcasts are put under the tag Dr. Hill Teach. If you look under it without that tag, you get into all the general podcasts that I produce, you know, like trials and stuff like that. And so a few people have said, oh, look, I'll just go underneath and actually follow the actual blog itself. So these people are listening to me reading or structuring a multiple choice question. It doesn't sound like anything because I chop it up. Now, and this won't take, this podcast will be a very short one. What happens is you listen to the audio file and you select different sections of it, fairly precisely, and that cuts it off and makes it as a little mini audio file. So I've created the software which takes that up into question blocks and arranges it in multiple choice, and I've created, I suppose, the high level schematics which looks at the three varieties of multiple choice questions. There's the radio show that you'd listen to a multiple choice as you're going along. It might be a bit boring. It's usually good to have an audience and a bit of a, you know, someone trying it and failing. You know, someone's listening to it, and then it's really best if someone gives their idea first. Then the answer's given. So that's a radio show style, the classroom style where it's like a test, but the podcast reads out the questions, so you answer the ABCD, it gives you the answer sheet, and then it goes through the questions and answers one by one. So rather than the answer given straight after, the answer and explanation given straight after, the answer and explanation is given in a big chunk after all the things are corrected, so you correct them all, get the score, go across. And then there's a third route, is where the explanation is given, then the question and answer is given. Just, you know, if you're new to the field, it's just all too hard. So you can go through these different options. So I'm working on them, and I had looked at Audacity and thought, oh, this is absolute crap. I'll have to write something else. So I began to write something else, and you can hear from now the word began. There's certain things that you have to do in machine language to really get access to, say, MP3s and stuff like that. So if you've got a high level language, you can never really get the speed. So you've got to get a high level language looking at a something like VLC, which is then gets you down to that low level language. So you've got to pick sort of a hierarchy of computer languages such that you can get down to the low level stuff. You can always do that something with your high level computer language, but it takes an awful lot of overhead because there's so many options that it wants to go ahead. And I produced along there, and then looked at Audacity again and discovered other functionality of it, how you actually plug it away. So you've got a podcast and you've got to divide it up with certain sections, and I really had wanted to divide it up as you're speaking. So you've got to think about the cognitive load of what you're doing. You really want to focus everything on the presentation and forget everything else. And so what happens is that with Audacity, you go to your file, open the file up in Audacity, so that imports, takes a few seconds. Then you do the following things. You can add another track, or another stereo track, or you can add something called a label track. So this is just a track which goes underneath it. And don't ask me exactly how it works. And so you go into this track and you select this label track. You select a section of stuff, you know, audio, maybe hello there. Go back to when you can see hello there and just select it. It's quite easy to do. And then you do this mysterious thing. So you've got, let's go to Audacity, which is this open source software. So if you want to get Audacity and play around with full podcast yourself, you just go onto the internet, Audacity, download, and open it up. And it's fairly simple. You then poke around in Audacity under the file, press open, and then go and select a file. Or you can actually just grab a file and drop it into Audacity. Okay, and we'll open up them. And so you get immediately two tracks if it's in stereo. And then underneath that, it says under, I don't know what it is, tracks or something like that, add a new track. And rather than add a track, it's just called a label. And for that label, you can then, with your mouse and the labels, drag it across and select. So you have the time select tool, which is a sort of a double bracket, sort of double square bracket next to each other. And you select your piece of word, and then you press Control B. This is all things that I've sort of discovered last night. I went, oh crap, this is the best. It's actually better than what I was planning. So, damn it. So that's, I don't know, a few hours work down the tube. Not necessarily down the tube, because I can still use it in different ways. And as I was playing around with it, I discovered faults. You know, necessary things to make it bulletproof. And I had sort of also in that few hours built the superstructure for it, so it wasn't a complete waste of time. But indeed, it just means that now to go forward, you really need Audacity. So what happens is you select your section, and then you press Control B. Now, when you press Control B, it comes up with some letters, such a text screen, which you can put in your labels, and you can enter it in there. But if you're, say, I've got 10 multiple choice questions, and the questions option 1, 2, 3, you've got 6. So that's for 10 choice questions. There's 60, really about 62 or 61 pieces of text you have to do, to separate out off to it. So any piece of text will be, the questions will be put three times in a way, the answers will be structured in different ways, randomized, or places like that. So identify it. So you could, initially experiment a type in there, and that's quite a nifty thing to do. What I'm doing is just ignoring that and just pressing Control B enough, and then I'll go on to the next one. As soon as you mouse off, you don't get to edit the, what's inside. So at the moment I have to do this to capture the generic things, the things that shall be in every multiple choice quiz. And so when that's there, then you can say, I think it's export multiple. And export multiple is a few steps to go. So export uncompressed. It's just how compatible that's with, I think. So if you export uncompressed, it saves as WAV files, these very bulky bloatware files. And given that you're going to novel quality, you may as well, I put it into MP3, I may leave it in WAV files. And then you can say, give it the label name, blah, blah, or just number it with your starting piece of text. And sort of put the numbering. The only irritating thing is that each file, it comes up and says, oh, what's the cover information? Because MP3, you've got to remember, is an audio, compressed audio section, but it's got a front file and a back file with it. So it's an MP3 file is actually concatenated three files. This is why an MP3 file just can't be added to an MP3 file. A WAV file can be added to a WAV file because it doesn't have editing, but MP3, so it's a bit irritating. Can you imagine 60 times you do a multiple choice and you've got to click 60 times to say nothing on the cover, nothing on the cover. So there must be a way around that. But the thing is, then you direct it to a file and your file fills up. And so what's necessary next is to, once you've done through there, is go through, listen to each one, and assign it to basically one of 10 questions, which is fairly easy. Click down. Oh, there's a gee whiz, the birds are attacking a game. I don't know if you can hear it. That's a king parrot. It's just arrived here. So we are pretty lucky in Australia. We thought, oh gosh, it's coming a bit closer. Hi mate. Oh, it's within, I don't know, 10 feet. Well, it's now 1 meter away. What are you going to do? Oh, these birds are pretty, not these ones. There's other birds which are pretty dangerous. That is, they carry lots of diseases with them, so you really want to wash your hands definitely You definitely don't want your food out with the food, with the birds around. That's a couple of years ago. A lot of people died due to bird infections. Oh, yeah. It's got my cup of tea. You stay away from my cup of tea, mate. Okay. So, it is a bit distracting. You can ignore people, but you really can't ignore animals, coming up to you. That's the, overall thing. So I've got to relabel it afterwards. So it's just a lot of effort down the track. And it just seems it's taking forever, effort to push through it. So that's where the Podomation's up to. So, it's in terms of coming forward, I have to go and investigate the technology to have a microphone, one of those microphone gibs, and the earphones only cost $2 each. And it's almost as soon as I found out they were $2 each, they stopped breaking. So I put it there, but it also limits the quality with which you can listen to things, and I'll have to get a microphone version of it and see if it how it works in the podcast. So that's where we're up to at the moment, and so it'll be slow going. It's sort of a dip in the amount of podcasts that I could produce in a day due to the due to having to do other exercises going through. You'll notice that I've been able to podcast while driving, and it's just push. Thanks a lot, and I'll continue doing other backup podcasts. Anzac House would become a place to carry out the objectives of the League and to assist members of the fighting forces and the dependents and returned servicemen and women. Heading 1948, the hunt for a design commences. To find a suitable design for the new RSL headquarters, the League launched an architectural competition. Architects from Australia and New Zealand were invited to submit an entry, the winning design to receive a £1,000 prize in honour of producing the best plan for the RSL headquarters. The brief was drawn up. This building should express the spirit and the same values of life the men it honours it fought. It will have a soul within it, forming part of the spiritual cultural life of our city, a monument to the dead as well as the service to the living. March, this magazine, 1948. 49, an award-winning design is selected. That's the heading. Out of 39 entrants, Walter Bunning and Charles Madden, a World War II veteran, were announced as the winners of the architectural competition. With their contemporary design, drawing upon Australian and Swedish influences, the winning blueprint was dubbed the Emblem of Services and Sacrifice. The original Anzac House was erected in 57 in Sydney's College Street, housing RSL New South Wales and other ESOs. Anzac House remained at this site until around 87, when it moved to Kent Street before settling on 245 Castleway Street in 96. For the past 20 years, RSL New South Wales has worked to support veterans across the state from Anzac House and Castleway Street. This location has seen many changes in the milestone for the RSL, including the inception of the RSL Defence Care and Centenary of Anzac. New chapter. With a recent move to 331 George Street, RSL and New South Wales seeks to continue the spirit of why Anzac House was first established, respecting, supporting and remembering our veterans and families. Next article. Remembering the Battle of Coral Balmoral. Okay, so that's a Vietnam thing. Intense conflict on even greater scale than Long Tan is commemorated 50 years after this major event in the Vietnam War. So, I think we lost 12, we lost 15 in combat in the Vietnam War and 550 all up due to various deaths and stuff like that. I think there was one reserve person lost and roughly equal numbers of Nashos, conscripts and professional soldiers. In May 68, Australian soldiers fought their largest, most sustained, arguably most hazardous battle of the Vietnam War. Units of the 1st Australian Task Force, 1ATF, confronted a regiment-sized formation of North Vietnamese Army, NVA, or People's Army of Vietnam, in a succession of fierce actions around the fire support bases Coral and Balmoral in the Ben Hoa province. Australian soldiers prevailed at a heavy cost to the enemy and their own troops. Yet the significance of these battles was not widely recognised at the time. 50 years later, they can be seen more clearly as the inevitable culmination of major military and political events unfolding in the wider war. In 1968, the Vietnam War was mired in stalemate, in the words of the American CBS News reporter Walter Cronkite. Despite a massive escalation of American ground and air sea forces, victory in South Vietnam seemed no closer than it was 3 years earlier, when the United States and Australia first committed combat troops. The Viet Cong, together with the North Vietnamese Army allies, had suffered a major setback in South Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, launched during the Lunar New Year ceasefire. But despite these, their heavy losses, they achieved an unintended propaganda political victory. U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson announced a halt to the aerial bombing of North Vietnam and extended an offer of peace negotiation to the communist regime in Hanoi. Formal peace talks were scheduled to begin in Paris on the 13th of May, but a week before they commenced, the communists launched a second major offensive in the south with a wave of attacks on Saigon. Meanwhile, In early April, the 1st Australian Task Force had joined Operation Tuan Thang, the biggest Allied operation in the war so far, involving 70,000 Vietnamese, American, Australian, New Zealand and Thai troops. The focus of operations shifted to the northwest. On the 12th of May, two Australian infantry battalions with artillery and support units moved to establish a fire support base, Coral, north of Ben Hoa City, on the approaches to Saigon. This move was a leap into the unknown. The area contains infiltration routes used by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army forces that had attacked Saigon a week earlier. The enemy were now expected to use these routes in withdrawing from the capital. During the insertion, little proceeded according to plan. The fly-in by helicopter was delayed and there was confusion over the misplacement of some units. Despite detailed intelligence reports, the enemy retreat was underestimated. Concerns about a substantial enemy presence only arose after the force was committed. The Australians were about to face a much more aggressive, better equipped and better trained enemy than they had encountered previously during the counterinsurgency operations of Phu Toi province. As night fell over the scattered positions, infantry, artillery and supporting arms were located around Coral in a hurried deployment intended to just last the night. With a few prepared positions, most of the men had only time to dig individual shell scrapes less than a metre. The Australians were unaware that the enemy reconnaissance soldiers had observed their protected and confused insertion and reported back to their headquarters under the cover of darkness and rain. An augmented battalion of NVA regiment dug in undetected just 250 metres from the base and attacked in the early hours of the 13th of May. Australian units withdrew enemy attacks using during which a mortar platoon and two gun positions were partially overrun. They drove off the enemy after more than 2 hours of fierce close-quarter actions. The battle abated at dawn. The task force suffered losses of 11 killed in action and 28 wounded, with an average age of 22. In one mortar platoon, 5 soldiers were killed and 8 wounded from a total of 18 men. Okay, so that's sort of the second biggest loss in the Vietnam War. Alright, there we go. The enemy left 52 dead in and around the fire support base. Radio Hanoi and the local communist propaganda claimed a victory, yet the Australians knew that they had inflicted heavy losses on the enemy even if it had been a close contest. The action led to a change in the concept of the operation. With the well-defended fire support bases sighted squarely on the enemy's line of approach, Australian forces induced NVA commanders to launch repeated attacks which were repelled with heavy enemy losses. Combined infantry tank patrols resulted in further enemy casualties and the destruction of enemy bases. Over 4 weeks, the action of Australian soldiers led to more than 300 enemy soldiers being killed and hundreds of enemy weapons being captured. In return, 26 Australian soldiers died and approximately 100 were wounded. Australian soldiers had performed with distinction. Regiments involved were later awarded battle honours. with the honour title Coral awarded to the 102 Field Battery and 34 decorations awarded to individual soldiers. On the 50th anniversary of the battle at Firebase Coral, a unit citation for gallantry was awarded to recognise all participants for extraordinary gallantry in action. Battles marked a watershed in the Australian Task Force. For the first time since Longtown, the Australians faced the North Vietnamese armies, forced in regimental strength. Initially poorly prepared, they engaged the enemy with a pitched battle for more akin to conventional warfare than counterinsurgency and had repelled a massive attack. The actions demonstrated the changing nature of the war and the changing composition of the tactics of the enemy force. The conflict increased in intensity, the emphasis would now be on facing large formations of regularly North Vietnamese army troops, as well as southern Viet Cong guerrillas and the main force units. The Vietnam War continued to confound strategists and shift in scale and intensity until the Australian forces withdrew in 1972. About the author, Ashley Eckens is chief historian at the Australian War Memorial. Okay, this is the role of everyone, of the little diggers who died. List of them, I won't read them through to you. Okay. The end of an era. 20 years ago, a Reserve Force Day plan was developed and accepted at the Defence Department. After 20 years, it was decided that this year's parade on the 1st of July would be the last one. Okay, so there was going to be a Reserve Force, and I'm part of the Reserve Force. And why would it be there? On the 19th of February, 1998, an Honourable Bronwyn Bishop launched the Reserve Forces Day in Sydney. She was accompanied by the New South Wales patron, His Excellency Gordon Samuels, huge number of letters, and Sir Lawrence Street, huge number of letters, the New South Wales chairman. The reason for the day was to raise the profile of the Reserve Forces to thank the employers, the wives and partners for the support. The plan was to have a special parade to celebrate the reforming of the Citizens Military Force on the 1st of July 1948 to celebrate its 50th anniversary in 1998. The Citizens Force was reformed at the beginning of 1947, although at different times in other states of Australia, and the Royal Australian Navy Reserve resumed in 1950. Nationally, 4,000 serving and 18,000 former members from 12 cities took part in the parade. This number of participating cities grew to more than 20 cities having parades, including the capital cities of each state and territory. The USA accepted an invitation in 1998 to participate in the Brisbane Parade. Most of the members of the five United States Reserve Forces had never been to Australia and were impressed by the enthusiastic welcome they received whenever they went. Over the following years, Reserve Forces of USA, UK, Canada and New Zealand attended parades and celebrations. It is pretty amazing. Especially back in the 80s when you'd march down the street, people come out and cheer, yay! Okay. In the lead up to the initial parade, a separate committee was formed to canvass members to join the RSL. Many now serving executive positions and sub-branches. Over the years, a theme was selected to assist the publicity and marketing of the day, for example, core birthdays. Over the last 5 years, the theme celebrated the centenary of major activity in World War I. The first of this series was the centenary of the Australian Naval and Military Expeditional Force to capture German New Guinea. This year was a very appropriate one to finish, as it was the centenary year of the successful Battle of Hamel and Amiens and the Australian Corps led by Sir John Marsh, a reserve officer. So this is interesting that although the reserves are chocos, they provided the key Australian military leaders. The Reserves Forces Day Council's decision to hold the last national parade after 20 years was influenced by the aging membership of the Reserve Association. The final parade was held at Anzac Memorial at Hyde Park in Sydney the 1st of July. More than 15 regimental associations formed during the past years. Of all members found, the parade brought together mates who had not seen each other since they'd served together. The parade was well attended by association members who were each presented with a red ribbon to wear on the right lapel and were awarded a 1998 golden red bar to add to their ribbon if they had taken part in the 98 parade. It was a great incentive to thank members for their participation. More than 500 badges were awarded to participants of the 1998. The council archives are to be stored in the Australian War Memorial. So that was just a little thing that's popped up and gone. So you still have a good story. And honouring the cross. For the first time in Australia, at least one surviving ACC recipient from every Commonwealth country attended an event, the annual Narra Digger Day. Well, there you go. What the heck is that? A popular event that started 7 years ago, hosted by Narra Sub-Branch Digger Day, was established to celebrate all men and women who had served in the Australian Defence Force, including those who will serve in the future. This year was an extra special as we close in on the end of the ANZAC centenary, said Rick Mayhem, OM, Honorary Secretary of the Narra Sub-Branch. I felt that Digger Day had to be an event bigger than usual. Important guests include Johnson Bihari, Ramabur Limbu, Willie Alpeter and Keith Payne. Sadly, illness kept VC recipient Keith Payne from the actual event. When I accepted my invitation, that was a special moment, remembers Rick. But the defining moment was when I knew they were all on their respective planes flying to Sydney, and when I checked them into the motels. That moment I'll never forget. The morning began with a meet and greet with the Narra RSL sub-branch, where the Victoria Cross, George Cross and Cross of Valour recipients came together. There were so many highlights of Digger Day of 2018, but I think personally meeting the last living Gurkha VC recipient from Nepal was a great moment. Pretty amazing. VC, GC and VC recipients transported in style to the rugby field of the naval helicopters. The afternoon brought an exciting rugby match between local team Shoalhaven and the rifle Cameron. Oh dear. The local team won the match 100-5, with Rick commenting that it could be seen as a point scored for every year marking the ANZAC. Oh god. Another highlight, says Rick, was Willie Appeter, a VC from New Zealand, who sang the song in Maori. It was amazing to receive a standing ovation. There were how many people there. Day finished at the Gala Charity Ball, at which the VCGC VC recipients spoke about the actions that led to their awards. Importantly, mental health is a topic of discussion of many speakers, especially now PSD is affecting them individually. A song message is you're never alone, you always ask for help when needed. Okay, big thing with these people with helicopters coming along. My children love reading about the living like the rich famous bidet, which is their thing. And we'll skip through the sub-branch news. And see if there's a good article here. And it looks as though we're coming to the end of this magazine. Thanks for listening. Limited edition Armistice's Centenary Bear. Okay, you can buy a teddy bear in Australian World War I uniform, which celebrates the Armistice. Saluting all who served. 40-centimeter collectible bear includes World War I campaign medals, Flanders poppy, centenary armistice armband, and numbers certificate of authenticity. Of course, you definitely would want it. Yeah, there you go. Well, that's only $100. Thanks a lot.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.